about the Old Testament canon tonight. And what you see here over my right shoulder is what the Hebrew language looks like when it's written. Now, this is the Hebrew, well, you'll see in just a minute, this is the Hebrew that comes from the Aleppo Codex. But as we get into this, you'll understand a little bit about what some of those funny looking marks mean that are there on the page. When we talk about the Old Testament, of course, we're talking about the 39 books, the way that we count them, the way that they're divided up in our New Testament, or in our Old Testaments, generally speaking, that you buy at Barnes and Noble or anywhere else you might go to buy a Bible. And I've broken them up into an organizational pattern that most of us are really familiar with. First five books, we call the books of the law. The next 12, we call the books of history. And it's pretty easy to remember that there are 12 of them. It's the two men and a woman, and then the first and seconds, and then again, two men and a woman. And if you think about the history, Joshua, Judges, and Ruth are written as people are coming into the land of Canaan. First and Second Samuel, First and Second Kings, and First and Second Chronicles are written while the kingdom is in existence. And in fact, First and Second Samuel and First and Second Kings are the history in order. And then First and Second Chronicles goes back and retells the history from the priestly point of view. Chronicles is from the priestly point of view. First and Second Samuel, First and Second Kings are basically from the king's point of view. So it's interesting that you get that repetition. You get the same repetition in the first five books, because remember, Deuteronomy is Moses repeating the history that has already been told. And then to finish up the 12 books of history, you have two men and a woman. This is the period when Israel comes back to the land from Babylonian captivity, and they rebuild the land, rebuild the temple, rebuild the city. Then you have the wisdom books, Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. This is what most people call kind of the heart of the Bible. In fact, if you take your Bible and you put just Bible between your hands and you open it to the middle, you'll open it to the heart of the Bible, and you'll probably be in the book of Psalms somewhere. Then you have the prophets. You have five major prophets, 12 minor prophets. And the only distinction between major and minor is how long their books are. You have to understand that the prophets worked alongside the kings. So I think everybody realizes that. We've been studying Ezekiel, and we know when Ezekiel was written. We know who the kings were that Ezekiel was working with, or perhaps in Ezekiel's case, after they have been in captivity for a period. But that's the Old Testament, kind of as we have it in our hands. The question really is, how did we get here? How did we get 39 books in the Old Testament canon? Where did they come from? So that's what we're going to try to talk about tonight. Now, if you were to read a Jewish Bible, you wouldn't see that kind of an organization. 39 books. What you would see is something very different. You would only see 24 books the way that they have them organized, but it includes all of the material that's in our 39 books. If you look at the books of Moses, you see the same five. There's no change. That's pretty much exactly the same. But then when you look at the prophets, you see that they have Joshua, Judges, which are typically not books that we call prophets. We think of them more as history. Samuel, again, which is history. Kings, which is history. And then the only books that we think of as being prophets are Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and what they call the 12. And the 12 was all of the minor prophets lumped together in one book. The other thing you'll notice about the Jewish order of the canon is that they don't divide 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings, nor do they divide 1st and 2nd Chronicles. They put them all together as just one book. Now, then you go over further to the writings, and they have Psalms, Proverbs, Job, Song of Solomon, and Ecclesiastes. That's what we commonly think of as the wisdom literature. They call that the writings. You also have Ruth, which we think of as history, Lamentations, which we think of as prophet. They have Esther, Daniel, and then one book that combines Ezra and Nehemiah, and then they have the Chronicles. Because remember, as we pointed out, the Chronicles are kind of the priestly commentary on all of the things that happened during the reigns of the kings in Israel. Now, when I talk about this kind of an organization, what I'm talking about is something called, well, what the rabbis called the Tanakh, T-A-N-A-C-H. And that's an acronym that's made from the first Hebrew letter of each one of these divisions. So you have the Chumash, that's the books of Moses, the Nevi'im, which is the prophets, and I'm probably butchering these pronunciations, so forgive me. Then you have the Kesubim, which is the writings. They call that the Tanakh, at least in rabbinic Judaism, they called it the Tanakh. When I talk about rabbinic Judaism, I'm talking about the Jewish system that was in place when Jesus came. Rabbinic Judaism really grew up during the Babylonian Empire. While the children of Israel were in Babylonian captivity, you had the development of the Pharisees. Prior to the Babylonian captivity, you never see the Pharisees mentioned. But while they were in captivity, you got the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Essenes, the rabbis became the teacher class. And most of the rabbis were Pharisees. And then you'd always had the priests. In the Old Testament, the priests were supposed to be the teachers, but then you develop this specific group called the rabbis, and the rabbis were the ones who controlled or had a, I shouldn't say controlled, but they had a major influence on Judaism. Now it was during the ascendancy of the rabbis that you had the development of what's called the Masoretic text. And the Masoretic text, by the time Jesus comes on the scene, is what is used as the best definition of the Jewish canon. And it also included something very special. Now let's think, I'm going to come back to this in just a minute. Let's think about how the Jewish language developed. The Jewish language, where'd it go? I trashed that slide. I shouldn't have. The Jewish language, at least in its written form, has no vowels. So imagine a word would be MN. But if you have no vowels, you don't know whether that word is moon or mane like a horse has or man, because when you supply the vowels, then you make it into a word that we're more likely to be familiar with. It could even be mean, an adjective that describes a person. So there's a lot of opportunity in Hebrew because you don't have vowels to become confused about what the words really mean. So what happened is the Masoretes, which is the copyists, the scribes and the rabbis who developed the written Hebrew text, did some very special things. The first thing they did was they put vowel points in. Remember back at the very beginning, I was showing you what a Hebrew writing looks like. See all those little points down underneath of the letters? Well, those are called vowel points. And what they do is they tell me whether or not the word MN should be mane like a horse or man or mean as a descriptor or moon. That's the first thing that they did. The written Hebrew has no vowels, so they had to define the vowel points. And once the Masoretes did that, that helped to define what each word in the original was. The second thing that's important about the Masoretic text is that they added what are called diacritical marks. Now, that's not what they called them. That's what we call them today. If you're old enough, you'd have to be older than I am, probably, to remember in elementary school learning all of the diacritical markings. Does anybody remember learning about those? Where you get the short A and the long A, and you have little slashes and curly Q's over the letters in a word that would tell you how to pronounce the word?
Yes.
Okay. So at least some of us learned those. I was supposed to have learned them, but I didn't. Always just kind of fell back on the way my parents pronounced the word because they had learned the diacritical markings and they tended to pronounce words properly. So if I mispronounce a word, it's because my dad mispronounced the word and I pronounce it the same way he did. I didn't learn the diacritical marks, but the diacritical marks or the pronunciation of the word distinguishes between words that might have the same spelling. And we have a lot of those words in English. One of them is the word R-E-C-O-R-D. Now, if that's a noun, that's a record. And that's the way the diacritical marks look, if you were telling somebody how to pronounce that word as a noun. So if you put those diacritical marks in, you specify that when you see that word, it's a noun. And it means some piece of evidence about the past. You keep a written record. Or the sum of past achievements and how your achievement rates relative to the other achievements. You did that in record time. But you, when you include the diacritical marks, you take that word, R-E-C-O-R-D, and you specify that it's going to be the noun form of this word. Now, if you want the verb form, you use different kinds of diacritical marks. And you see that up there on the screen. That's when you record. That's the way you would write it in diacritical markings if you wanted to specify that you were using the verb. And that's to set something down in writing, to record it, or to convert into some kind of a permanent form for reproduction later. You would say you recorded a guitar solo, or you recorded everything that you ate or drank during the last week, if you were keeping a food diary, perhaps. So, second thing that the Messorites did with the Jewish text is they added diacritical marks. And that helped, again, to make sure that people didn't misunderstand what originally was, could have been very confusing. And then the third thing that's in the Masoretic text is these marginal commentaries. Now, this is a page from the Aleppo Codex. It's one of the oldest surviving Masoretic text pages. And you see three columns here. And between the columns, you see extra notations. Now, that's because they didn't want to change the text, but they did want to make comments to make sure that people got it correct. So you have little short commentary that's in the columns next to the text. And then you have longer commentary, which is that stuff at the bottom of each column. And then you have what they called the final commentary. And the final commentary was added at the end of the text, and it was written. So again, the effort was to make sure that they didn't, that there was no confusion about what the text really said. So the Masoretic text does a great deal to constrain confusion about the original of the Hebrew text. It was primarily copied and edited by a group of Jews that were known as the Masoretes, or Masoretes, excuse me, between the 7th and the 10th centuries. The oldest extant manuscript comes from about the 9th century. The Aleppo Codex was partly destroyed during the civil war in Palestine, and it dates during to the about the 10th century. So they worked from about the 5th through the 10th century, primarily in medieval Palestine, in Tiberias and Jerusalem, as well as in Iraq, in the city of Babylon. Now, that makes a lot of sense because rabbinic Judaism got its start among the Jewish exiles. Now, you know, as I had described, the copyists who worked to copy the Old Testament Hebrew, of course, they didn't have Xerox machines. You couldn't run down to Kinko's and make a Xerox. You had to hire somebody by hand to copy everything that was in the text. Well, the way that those copyists got paid was on the basis of the number of letters that they wrote. Now, if you were thinking about copying something like Homer's Iliad, the great Greek poem, you would get paid by the number of lines that you wrote. That was called a stick, a line. The prose verse was never written in sticks, so the copyists, in order to figure out how much to get paid, counted the letters. It was apparently something that they did in order to get paid. Now, that also has the secondary benefit of ensuring accuracy in the transmission of the text when subsequent copies were done by hand, because they're counting letters. I had always assumed that they counted letters to make sure that they were as accurate as they could be. And it may be that that was part of the reason for it, but it seems from what I can read that the primary reason for them counting the number of letters in each page was so that they could get paid. I think I may have overstated that case in the past when I was talking about it, because I quoted what I had read other people saying. And when I, in the course of preparing this material, I actually tried to source that, and I went back and tried to find where that was described, and it really wasn't described. So we need to be careful not to overstate the case when we're talking about these things. Now let's go on to these copies that we have of the Old Testament canon. When scholars try to study the language of the canon in the Old Testament, they look at a lot of other sources besides just the Masoretic text. Masoretic text is in that chart that's over my shoulder. It's where it says MT, that stands for Masoretic text. That's kind of almost up above my head. Now, up and to the left of that, kind of in a northwest direction, you see the word Vulgate. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. And then down almost at the bottom of the text, but really the almost the lowest line of the text, you see LXX. That's the Septuagint version. All of these others are in reality pretty minor texts that scholars look at, but most people don't spend much time looking at most of these others. The one that they look at the most is the Peshitta, and that's kind of right in the middle of this whole mess. Now, what you see here is solid lines that indicate that this text came, the one that's farther up the chart, came from a text that was lower down the chart. The problem is when you look at the MT, Masoretic text, it, we think, came from a text that we don't have anymore. And that text came from a text that we don't have anymore. And that text came from a text that we don't have anymore. We've never found that copy of the text. Now, the text that's at the very bottom of all of this is called the Urtext. That's the oldest version of the Hebrew canon, but we've never found it. We just sort of, well, based on the development of language and words and the introduction of words and grammatical forms, that's kind of beyond what I can adequately describe. Linguists say that that probably existed. So we don't have the Urtext. The oldest text that we have is the Septuagint. But most of Rabbinic Judaism is based on the Masoretic text. And what you see is that the Septuagint and the Masoretic text came from different roots. And we'll talk about that a little bit in a minute as we continue our discussion. So anyway, most scholars and most scholars who are believers tend to look at the texts of Old Testament passages from a range of sources. And they include the Septuagint, the Peshitta, the Samaritan Pentateuch, and that one is not even listed on this chart. They look at the Dead Sea Scrolls. And again, remember, we're still discovering copies, old copies of these things. So they look at the Dead Sea Scrolls. They look at quotations from other rabbinic manuscripts. Some of that information is older than the surviving Masoretic text. And occasionally there are differences, not a great many differences. The text of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Peshitta is somewhere in between the Masoretic text and the Septuagint or the Old Greek text. The consonants in the Masoretic text are not very different from the Qumran texts of the second century. But when you look at the vowel points, there is some difference. I think everybody knows that the Septuagint was translated during the Ptolemaic Empire, the Greek Empire. It was a translation of the Hebrew scriptures from Hebrew into Greek during the 3rd to 2nd centuries BC. So that makes the Septuagint about somewhere between 700 and 1,000 years older than the Masoretic text. But it was the Masoretic text that was used most frequently in the Holy Land or Jerusalem and Judah, that was quoted most frequently by the writers of the New Testament, especially Paul, when he quotes Old Testament statements. Now we have another text, a Leviticus fragment that was discovered that in Gedi, it was carbon dated to the 3rd or 4th century. And surprisingly, it's completely identical to the Masoretic text. So, excuse me. What that tells me is once a text was settled on by the Masoretes, when they copied it precisely. So you went from the 3rd century when the Engedi scroll was written all the way up to the 7th century, 400 years, and it's completely the same. Now, how does that play out for us? Well, the Masoretic text is the basis for most Protestant translations of the Old Testament, like the King James, the English Standard, the New American Standard, and the New International Version. After 1943, when we began to discover more material, it continued to be used for some versions of Catholic Bibles. It was used for the New American Bible, which is a Catholic Bible, and the New Jerusalem Bible. So the reason that we have 39 books in our New Testament is, especially because most people are familiar with the King James, is that those 39 books were the same as the 24 books that were in the Masoretic organization. Now they combined a couple, remember Ezra and Nehemiah. They combined all of the first and seconds, but we have the same books. We just divide them up a little bit differently. Now, Catholics tend to include some other books that most Bibles don't include. It's also true that the Eastern Orthodox Church includes most of these books. And that's not surprising, again, because the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church basically came out of the same origin. So there, in your outline, you see a list of those books that were included by Catholics and Eastern Orthodox, but are not generally included in our Bibles, in the Bibles that are used by most Protestants. Now, the Eastern Orthodox Church even includes some books that the Catholics don't include. And you see a list of those. 1st Esdras, 3rd Maccabees, 4th Maccabees, the Prayer of Manasseh. They also include Psalms 151. I should say that not only do the Catholics include some extra books, the books that they include, like Daniel, also includes some material that is not in the book of Daniel the way that we have it in our Bibles. And they also have some additions to Esther, but they're not as well defined. The Russian Orthodox Church includes 2nd Esdras, the Ethiopian Orthodox Church includes 4 books, and I'm not going to even try to pronounce 1st, 2nd, and 3rd mega, whatever that word is, M-E-Q-A-B-Y-A-N. The Syriac Peshitta, that's that one that I told you about, that includes 4 extra psalms that really nobody else includes. Beta Israel includes some different books. In the Greek Septuagint, you also see the inclusion of the Psalms of Solomon. in addition to the Psalms of David. So let's kind of go through this and try to make some sense out of it and come to some conclusions and talk a little bit about why it's important to understand where the organization that we have came from. Now, the earliest evidence of some sort of Hebrew canon list, and remember, a canon is just it's a ruler, it's a straight line, it's what's absolutely recognized. The earliest evidence, explicit evidence, of a Hebrew canon list comes from Josephus, who wrote about 37 to 100 AD. And he wrote a canon, wrote about a canon that was used by the Jews in the first century. And then I have this long quotation from Josephus, book one, Against Appian, that's his book, and it's book one, paragraph 8. And he describes the division of the Bible into the 5 books of the Torah, 13 books of the prophets, and 4 books of hymns. So it was a little bit different than the Masoretic text. And he says this is his statement. We have not an innumerable multitude of books among us disagreeing from and contradicting one another as the Greeks have. And of course, at that point, he's referring to the Septuagint. But we have only 22 books. Now remember, there are 24 books in the Masoretic text, which contain the records of all the past times, which are justly believed to be divine. And of them, 5 belong to Moses, which contain his laws and the traditions of the origin of mankind until his death. This interval of time was little short of 3,000 years, but as to the time from the death of Moses until the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, who reigned after Artaxerxes, the prophets who were after Moses wrote down what was done in their times in 13 books. That's what we call the books of history. The last 4 books, or the remaining 4 books, contain hymns to God and precepts for the conduct of human life. It is true, our history hath been written since Artaxerxes very particularly, but hath not been esteemed of the like authority with the former by our forefathers. And what he's talking about is that 400 silent years. He says, because during that time, there has not been an exact succession of prophets. And how firmly we have given credit to these books of our own nation is evident by what we do, for during so many ages as have already passed, no one has been so bold as either to add anything to them or to take anything from them. And he's talking about the 22. The Masoretes would have said 24. We would probably say 39. Or to make any change in them. Remember, the Masoretes didn't want to change the way that the text was written. So they just added vowel points below the text, or they put comments in the margins. He says, it has become natural to all Jews immediately and from their very birth to esteem these books to contain divine doctrines, to persist in them. And this is the point that I was making last week, if occasion be, willingly to die for them. So you would be willing to give your life to rescue the 22 books, but you wouldn't rescue the other stuff. It was good stuff, but you wouldn't you wouldn't be willing to give your life for. For a long time, following the date during which Josephus wrote, which was about 95 to 100, the divine inspiration of Esther, the Song of Solomon, and Ecclesiastes was called into question. According to LaRue, who is a linguist who's done a lot of work here, Josephus' listing represents what came to be the Jewish canon, although scholars were still wrestling with problems of the authority of certain writings of the time that he was, at the time that he was writing. Josephus's 22 books were not universally accepted because there were other Jewish communities that had more than 22. And we've already said the Masoretes divided it into 24 books. Now, the early church, Christian church, used the Septuagint frequently, since Greek was the lingua franca of the Roman Empire. So if you were writing during the time of Rome, you would quote from the Septuagint. And so that's what they used. It seems to have been the major source for the apostles, but it's not the only one. The phraseology that the apostles used is the same phraseology exactly in many cases that's in the Septuagint. New Testament writers reciting Jewish scriptures or quoting Jesus doing so frequently use the Greek translation, the Septuagint, as opposed to the Masoretic rabbinic text, implying that Jesus and his apostles and their followers considered that Greek text as being reliable. Now, this is really interesting. In the early Christian church, the Septuagint, which was translated by the Jews before the time of Jesus, seemed to be more like the Christological interpretation that Jesus gives it than the second century Hebrew text, that's the Masoretic text. And what they said was the Masoretes who translated the Masoretic text for the rabbis had changed the Hebrew text in a way that made it seem less Christological. That means less devoted to Christ. And the place where you see this the most is in the writings of Irenaeus. Irenaeus talks about Isaiah 7 at verse 14. In Isaiah 7 at verse 14, the Septuagint clearly talks about a virgin that shall conceive. Passage we're all familiar with. If you talk about the accuracy of some of the New Testament translations, the Septuagint talks about a virgin that would conceive. The Hebrew text, the Masoretic text, which at that time of Irenaeus had been translated by Theodotus and Aquila, says a young woman shall conceive. So Irenaeus contended that the Septuagint was the more accurate Christological view of the Old Testament than was the Masoretic text. Irenaeus even says that the Ebionites, a certain sect of the Jews, used that difference to conclude or to claim that Joseph was the biological father of Jesus. He is not born of a virgin. He is not the son of God. He is the son of Joseph. Now, from Irenaeus's point of view, the Masoretic text represented pure heresy. And it was facilitated by the anti-Christian alterations of the scripture in Hebrew as compared to the older Septuagint. Okay. Along comes Jerome. And Jerome put together the Vulgate. Now that text is a translation of the Hebrew Old Testament and the New Testament. It also includes the New Testament. But the Old Testament comes from the Hebrew text, the Masoretic text, rather than the Septuagint, the old Greek text. And remember, we've already seen Irenaeus says, oh, look what they did when they translated into the Hebrew, the Masoretic text. They changed it. So Jerome is criticized by Augustine. Some of his contemporaries even called him a forger or called him worse names. He really took a beating because of his use of the Masoretic text as the foundation for the Vulgate, the Vulgate compilation of books. Now, in the face of that, Jerome did take great pains to acknowledge the Septuagint, but that was not the basis for his translation or for his compilation of the Vulgate. And you have to remember, the Vulgate is in the line from which the King James was translated. So, you wind up with three kinds of books, three kinds of writings. And most scholars talk about them as the proto-canonical, the deuterocanonical, and the apocryphal books. So you have to divide between them. The proto-canonical books, that's the books of the Old Testament that are included in the Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh, the Masoretic text, the 24 books that came to be considered canonical during the period when the church began, the first century of Orthodox Christianity. When I say Orthodox, I just mean the church organized. Then you have the deuterocanonical. This is really interesting. That's not a word that I had really encountered very much until I was putting this together. Deuterocanonical books means belonging to the second canon. So it's kind of not as important as the proto-canonical books. That was the first canon. These are the secondary canon. And they're in many places included in the Septuagint, but they're not in the Masoretic text. They are considered by the Catholic Church, Eastern Orthodox Church, Assyrian Church of the East, to be canonical. But for the most part, we have rejected them. And they date from about 300 BC to 100 AD. Most of them are written from 200 BC, which is during that 400 years of silence, up to AD 70, when Jerusalem was destroyed. Interestingly, the New Testament writers never directly quote from or name any of those books, even though they frequently used and quoted the Septuagint that includes them. Some say that they didn't quote it specifically, but there's a great correspondence of thought. Some say that maybe the apostle paraphrased some stuff that came from those deuterocanonical books, but in large measure, we're safe to say that Jesus, the apostles, and the early church never quoted from those deuterocanonical books that are included in the Septuagint, but aren't a part of the Masoretic text. And then you have this third group of books. These are books that were of Jewish origin. Most were written after the destruction of Jerusalem. Sometimes they were read in Christian churches as scripture, but for the most part, they were not. They were not regarded typically as being a part of the canon. So I think we're safe in saying, based on what Jesus and the apostles and the other people who lived during that time, who wrote about the Old Testament, considered to be the canonical books, we're talking about the books that were included in the Masoretic text, the 24 books that we have now divided and made into 39 books, but it's the same books. Wow, we got through all of that in 1 hour. I can't tell you how long it took me to write that. Any questions at this point? I hope that this helps. I know that I'm getting a little far off into the weeds, but I hope that this increases your faith in the 39 books that we have included in the Old Testament, and you see the difference between the way that other deuterocanonical books were treated by the early Christians. Next week, we'll start on the development of the New Testament canon. And it's not quite so convoluted as this one turned out to be. So any questions, comments? You guys, some of you have spent a lot of time looking at this, and many of you have sent me material that I could use. It was, you know, I had to source it. Somebody says something, I have to go back and find where that was and just confirm in my mind that that's true. I'm not doubting what other people have to say, but, you know, if you read something that I had written, I would have said, for instance, that they counted the letters to ensure that they were accurate. And that may be an overstatement. They may have been counting the letters just because that's the way that they got paid. And it had the happy outcome of ensuring accuracy. I probably put everybody to sleep. Any comments, questions?
I guess that we've heard of Josephus ever since I can remember, and it is, the history is correct, of course, of that. And so I can see why that would be, quote, included as a proof of what we have to read. And I never doubted it, I suppose, really. When you go into, there's three or four names that I recognize, the Vulgate, and I don't remember which other, but I remember hearing those ever since I was a member of the church. And so it seems really real to me. Of course, I have the King James and the New King James, and then one of them has a revised version of something. And so they all say the same thing. If you don't have to know Greek or Hebrew to understand it.
Right. Right. It's just it's important to understand why those 39 books are in the Old Testament. How did we settle on those 39 and we didn't include, for instance, the Wisdom of Solomon? Good point. And you know, remember, Josephus is not, he's never been considered as a canonical writer. Josephus is not, he is by no means claiming to be inspired. In fact, Josephus is writing about the Jews to please the Romans.
So, it's kind of a history of what's going on right then when he wrote that.
Yeah.
Not that he was claiming to have any special thing, but he was mainly writing about the history that was going on right then. So. Yeah.
It was the history
when it was written again. Well, then we had all that.
Yeah, remember, Josephus writes the history the way that the Romans wanted the history to be written.
And that's true.
He's pretty accurate, but you just have to remember, he wrote the history the way the Romans wanted it to be written. Josephus was a Jew who had gone over to the Romans. He's paid by the Romans to write the history of the Jews. He does it.
Well, I don't know if you can take him 100% or not, but you could probably go 80% and be right. Because it just tells what was going on. It's like a history book.
That's true.
Even if, no matter if it's Hebrew or Roman.
That's true. And 1st and 2nd and 3rd and 4th Maccabees write those are books that are written about the same period of history, but if you read Maccabees, that's written by Jews for Jews, and it doesn't agree completely with Josephus, who is written by a Jew for a Roman. So, just
well, I've heard of the Maccabees a lot too, so that those two. If you read both of them, then you would get the real truth, I imagine. That would be my thinking anyway.
Yeah, that would be helpful to compare the two. You know, if you have to be careful when you read, even when you read what is supposed to be history, because people write a lot of their own opinions into history. So you just,
but it also says that not one jot or one tittle will be changed. So to me, that would indicate that it's right. Because it's not changed all these hundreds of years.
Yeah, that's why the Masoretes.
Thousands.
That's true. That's why the Masoretes, when they copied and tried to eliminate any confusion, they never changed the text. Remember, they put their vowel points under the text, or sometimes I think some of the vowel points go go over the text, and then they put their comments in the margins But they were always careful not to change the text. But because of what they did, they made sure that the reason that they were writing it, the reason they were translating it, was to make sure that you understood it the way you were supposed to understand it. And that was dictated by the rabbis.
And the King James has the emphasis on the, you can tell how it reads it. It tells you how to pronounce it in the King James.
That's true.
Bible.
That's,
puts all the pronunciation in there, punctuation.
In some King James translations, you see all those diacritical marks. They're not very helpful to most of us because we don't know how to read the diacritical marks.
Well, we do. We're old enough to know.
we were taught
it in school.
If you're old enough that you...
Yeah, I'm old. I can...
If you could look at the two different spellings of the word R-E-C-O-R-D and know whether it was a noun or a verb, you got it all over me.
Well, you can tell in the text what it means, though. I mean, even if you don't have the way to pronounce it, you still get the what it means.
Yeah, many times.
Right?
Many times. Not always, but many times.
If you don't get it right, some of us will tell you. You can't just go over that.
Some of us
old people do that.
I hesitate to tell you this, but if you copied down the diacritical marks and the spelling and you put it into the internet and say pronunciation, somebody will pronounce it for you and you can pronounce it like they do.
Maybe.
Yeah. Yes, it is. Those of us who don't.
The important thing is get the essence of it and what you're reading so that you can have salvation. And other than that, you don't have to know all of that stuff. You just have to know what the Bible says, because as we see through all of this stuff, it's accurate. You don't have to wonder about it.
Well, that in general,
so
I think
you just need to find out how to have salvation.
Yeah, in general, I think you're absolutely right. Let's see. I've got Ted's been admitting people here because he's my co-host. I don't even know who's online now. Ted, would you lead us in a closing prayer? And we'll see everybody. Well, tomorrow at 11 o'clock, June Roberts Memorial Service Celebration of Life is going to be here at the building. It'll also be available via Zoom, so you should have gotten a Zoom invitation for that as well. Then Sunday morning, Dick Malier is going to be preaching for us.